D-Mace, Fingan, and Donick 1025, the game, broadcasting from the Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Fingan, and David Janes here with you. Trevor Maddich will join us in roughly 20 minutes as we continue breaking down the fallout from the Titans' Week 1 loss to the Denver Broncos. The Titans host the LA Rams at Nissan Stadium on Sunday in Week 2. We were just talking about Calvin Ridley. I want to move on to Jeffrey Simmons. We did not get to Jeffrey Simmons yesterday. We spent most of yesterday talking about Brian Callahan, and we'll continue to talk about Brian Callahan. We're not moving away from that. But let's talk about Jeffrey Simmons in Denver, because I thought that performance by Jeffrey Simmons was both the good and the bad. According to the NFL, Jeffrey Simmons generated four pressures, including a strip sack, forcing multiple turnovers on his pressures for the first time in his career. Simmons generated as many pressures as the rest of the Titans pass rushers combined, also four. So Jeffrey Simmons had one of the best games of his career in terms of getting to the quarterback, according to the NFL. At the same time, he committed a neutral zone infraction early in the game that led to a Broncos first down on 3rd and 5. And then, of course, the play near the end of the game, the unnecessary roughness on 3rd and 10 late in the fourth quarter. Cody Barton had wrapped up Marvin Mims for a loss. Simmons runs in, pushes Barton. I believe he pushed Barton, right?
Yeah.
I think he had one of his hands on the ball carrier.
Right. Either way, called for unnecessary roughness. So I think that's both the good and the bad of Jeffrey Simmons. And we also do have, and we'll get to this in just a second, we do have a clip from Jeffrey Simmons after the game on the penalties, because he did take accountability. We'll play that in just a moment. But Willie, what did you make of Simmons' performance in Denver? Because again, in terms of pressuring and rushing the quarterback, you could argue this was one of his best games. But you also have to factor in the penalties as well.
Right. I don't think they're in the game if he is not playing as well. Because as you said, he was directly responsible for one of the turnovers and indirectly responsible for another. When he disrupted the pass that got intercepted, I thought he was playing spectacular. He was playing tremendous. All of the stuff that we talked about, he's lost weight, he's quicker. I thought they set him up. I could see what Denard Wilson was talking about within the scheme. It really looked like a great fit. And I'm thinking to myself, if I'm watching, they still don't have Tavondre Sweat at full strength. You know, Sneed's on the pitch count. If they could keep him out there a little more, you can see the makings of something. They're like, okay, this is what it's supposed to look like. So he was spectacular. But then just the enormous mental mistake at the end of the game. I couldn't believe. It was like the bad dream in slow motion. We're like, no, you know, don't do it. And he did it. Like, it's the key word is unnecessary. It wasn't that much, but they're going to call that every time. And I cannot believe he did that.
Let's go to Jeffrey Simmons after the game discussing the penalties and more from the Titans' loss in Denver.
Yeah, that's just frustrating part. Not even turnovers. We have four on defense, but it's the penalties, man. Like, you know, myself, don't hurt the team. And the penalties I had could have been avoided. Cody had them wrapped up. You know, it's just dumb. No excuses for that. You know, I take full accountability to that. And even with all the freaking penalties we had, we still was in this game. And we had a chance. But, I mean, when you have, over 150, I think it was like 150 in penalties?
130.
Or 130, that's terrible. And, you know, you'll never win a game like that, especially on the road. That's a good football team. But at the end of the day, man, we have to clean that up. Like I said, that's the most disappointing thing, especially coming out of this game, was the penalties.
Is that the biggest thing?
That was Jeffrey Simmons after the game. Derek, your thoughts on his performance at Denver?
I mean, he played a hell of a game. If you take away the last play, I don't even consider the neutral zone. I mean, it got in. Stuff like that usually doesn't get called unless the offensive lineman moves, or if he touches you, or you touch the offensive lineman. Typically, you do that, and they allow you to get back. they act as if, I don't know, because the offensive line reached and pointed, they called that potentially a false start on the offensive lineman. I don't think they would have called that a false start had he just pointed and been directing his offensive line. I don't believe they would have called that a false start. But to not give Simmons an opportunity to get back across the line of scrimmage, whereas clearly the offensive lineman didn't touch him and the ball wasn't hiked, I thought that was a little petty, and I'm pretty sure that Brian Callahan thought it was petty as well. So let's that one, I don't – that one to me is sort of in the big scheme of things. That's like a needle in a haystack to
May
me.
May I just say that one of my low-key favorite things about watching football is when somebody jumps offside and both players on both teams are pointing at the other players.
Yeah,
it was
they don't want to be, don't be wrong. They don't want to be wrong. So
just reminds me about being on the playground almost.
No, he did. I did. no, that not a last one. Listen, Jeff. That is just something you cannot. He understands it. So it's like me sitting here and sort of going in just to be going in makes no damn sense to me. But he knows better, and he can't have that. Again, I go back to what I said early on in the show. When you have one, two, three, four minus plays on a play, nine times out of ten, it ain't going to work. And then not let alone have a minus play on a play that worked and the play was over with, and then your minus becomes even bigger of an issue because now you've given them an extra first down in a game where you're trying to get the ball back because you're only down a few points. You're down one possession. So to me, those are the things that Jeff cannot do moving forward. He knows that. I know that. The city of Nashville know it. I mean, the state of Tennessee know it. Whoever loves the Tennessee Titans, they know. If they are going to win, especially on defense, you can't have bonehead plays like that. And Jeff knows that that was a bonehead play. Don't do dumb, you know what, to hurt the team, and that hurt the team. Jeff knows it, so
the play
I'm
was
done.
Over.
Yeah,
the
it was over. He knows it.
Pushing him back 10 yards. That you want him to release him and let him, but then it would be a 15 or 20-yard loss. Like, don't even go near there. That wasn't it. I would have liked. I don't know that they would have scored, but I would have liked to have seen Cam Ward have a little more chance in a 2-minute drill to have time to work with. The defense, I think the defense would have declared a really, really good performance. Mm-hmm. I hated that they gave up the 50-yard run, but you're nitpicking, right? You're not going to play perfect. They're not the steel curtain.
They got Ward down toward the end. Yeah, I get it. But
they're going to come up with a big stop to get their team the ball back with plenty of time. Plenty of time to work with and go down and see if you can have make something happen. You could put pressure on them, right? They would start to feel the pressure if you could move the ball a little bit. But you let them basically milk the clock.
A couple of texters point out that Jeffrey Simmons, quoting Mike Vrabel, don't do dumb blank to hurt the team in that clip. One texter says, Simmons gave a first down to Denver in the red zone, and it was on a third down. Shocked you're just accepting that as okay.
No, I'm not accepting it as, again, I'm just because I'm not screaming and yelling and going in on Jeff.
It was third and five.
Yeah, and they had stopped them, and they were getting ready to either kick a field goal or punt. Either way, they would have won. You would have had an opportunity to have the ball. So just because I am not sitting here going in and screaming and yelling doesn't mean I am not highly disappointed at Jeffrey Simmons and what he cost this team at that particular moment. It's just like a kid. You don't have to yell at kids to get them to understand and know that you're disappointed in what they did. So Jeff's the same way. Ain't no need of me sitting here yelling and screaming. Ain't no need for a coach to yell and scream. Jeff knows that if this team is going to win, it's going to be by the margins, okay, in between the margins. And this game is a matter of inches. Well, Jeff, you know on that play, you gave them 15 yards. I don't know what that equates to in inches, but you gave them 15 yards, free 15 yards, and he knows it. So what else do y'all want me to say? I don't know.
One texter, Ben, says, if the season stays pathetic, Jeffrey Simmons will be worth a first rounder if he keeps this up. I mean,
he's playing damn good, I tell you that. He's playing.
He's not lying, Willie.
He's playing damn good, man, I tell you that. Boy, that first half was just, that's the Jeffrey Simmons that I thought we were going to be getting after that one great year he had. So hopefully he can give us 6, 17, 16 more. If he does that, then the defense will be one of the top defenses in the National Football League.
I saw a scheme that looked like guys were on the same page. I thought they tackled really well. I thought they had an understanding of what Denver was trying to do. When a guy caught the ball on the flat, there was a guy on him. They made the tackle. They were asked to do a lot because the offense just didn't keep the ball very much. But I'm very optimistic about Denard Wilson as a coordinator, and he gets to match another great, proven offensive mind, Super Bowl-winning offensive mind next week in McVay. But I thought he won the chess match against the Broncos offense and Sean Payton on Sunday with limited personnel, right? But his best guy was a beast. That helps a lot. It makes everybody else better. That's the kind of stuff that you're looking for.
But your best guy can't hurt you either.
Right. And so then, he messed it up with one play.
So then, and you look at Devondre Sweat. I mean, that was, he did the best he could. I thought he played a good game, but had he been practicing and had not had the surgery, the minor surgery, then I think they would have got a better showing from Devondre Sweat in that situation.
But you still see the capability.
Oh, I still see it. Absolutely. You still see it. He's a force, and he wasn't even 100% yesterday. He's a force, and he's going to continue to be a force, and Jeffrey Simmons is going to continue to be a force, minus those bonehead plays. We can't have any more of those. If we have more of those, then maybe I'll raise my voice, Texter, if we continue to have those this season. But until then, that one, it cost us. But, hey, listen, in the big scheme of things, what I saw from Jeffrey yesterday, I mean, Sunday, was what I want to see for 16 more games.
Devondre Sweat played 40.8% of the snaps on Sunday. Last season, he played roughly two-thirds of the snaps. How much more do you think we see Devondre Sweat against the Rams?
I think you see, what'd you say, he played 40%?
He played 40.8% against the Broncos.
He'll play about 60%.
So he'll be closer to his average.
Depending on what the Rams do from an offensive scheme standpoint, I would tend to believe he'll be closer to the number he was at last year than what he was this past game.
You think so too, Willie?
I think that's possible. I still am concerned that he still is not going to be himself for another few weeks. I think it's going to take a while for him to really feel good and get his weight back up and be at game speed the way he can play, because I just think he missed so much time, he lost weight. That's just a tough thing. It takes time.
The same texter who asked the question, well, it was more of a statement, that we were just discussing, also just said, I threw my Simmons jersey in the stands in Denver. I'm over him. That one play. Keep in mind the great he did, that one play. Apparently, that jersey is trash now.
Well, man, you pay for the jersey, and then you're going to have to go buy another jersey of somebody else. I don't know.
Dustin and Hopkinsville. And
maybe that wasn't.
Dustin and Hopkinsville says, I have to clean this up because, Dustin, you've got a potty mouth in this text, so I'm going to have to clean it up. The one thing Big Jeff did right this offseason, he said, F it. F team ball. He says, I'm going to eat.
Yeah, basically.
Lost 20 pounds of fat. He's focused on his game. Who knows who the Titans are? He knows who the Titans are. He's not much of a leader, but the boy can play ball. That's what he needs to focus on.
Well, that is what he is focusing on, playing good football.
Language, Dustin.
Getting back to being that Jeffrey Simmons that afforded, you know, that afforded him that contract that he has. Listen, I think Jeff wants to be a leader. I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, question the leadership. Y'all can do that. Jeff wants to be a leader. He has to prove it to people consistently. But leaders can't have those, you know, brain farts that you had, you know, on the defense, especially at a critical time. I played with some great defensive guys. And guys that were considered leaders, guys that are Hall of Fame guys. And that didn't happen, especially not in critical moments. They found a way to keep their cool in the midst of what's going on. Because, listen, I'm not a defensive lineman, and I know the trenches can get down and dirty. So the mentality has to be such as. So I get that part. But, Jeff, the great ones, and you want to be great. And I don't think there's anything that's stopping you from being great. But the great ones don't, especially in key situations, the great ones don't do that. They don't do that. They find other ways to get their aggression out.
615-737-1025. We will take your thoughts on Jeffrey Simmons' performance on Sunday at Denver. We've also talked about Calvin Ridley, Brian Callahan. Anything is on the table Titans related. 615-737-1025. Coming up next, Trevor Maddich will join us, and we'll get his thoughts on what he saw in Denver on Sunday. Trevor Maddich coming up next, 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025 The Game. D-Mace, Vingan, and Donick, 1025 The Game. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan here with you, joined on our phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com, by Trevor Maddich, who is also brought to you by Houston Clinic Orthopedics, when experience matters. So, Trevor, the big talking point after the game on Sunday, Titans lose 20-12 to the Denver Broncos, was Brian Callahan. Namely, some of the decisions he made, and then him admitting after the game that he didn't quite know the rule about Elagaya Manor catching the ball, his elbow appearing to land inbounds. We took a lot of calls and texts about that. But I want your perspective as a player. As a player, would your faith be shaken in your head coach based on the decisions Brian Callahan made on Sunday?
Yes, absolutely would. As a player, you know, and you know this, D-Mace, I mean, the difference between winning and losing an NFL game often comes down to just one or two or three plays. And that's it. So you go through all that effort, have all those plays that you just fight tooth and nail, and you're getting hit in the mouth, and you're hitting them in the mouth, and you're hurting, and you're fighting to make a difference on those one or two or three plays. And the if you look at your coaches and can say they're putting me in position that if I do my part, we're going to win, or at least we have a good chance to win. That's good. That's what you want. If you are a player and you look at your coaches and you think, you know, no matter how hard I play, I have to overcome not just the opponent, but some dumb decisions by my coaches, then you lose faith pretty quickly. And so Brian Callahan has making up to do, in my opinion. That's how I would feel. I haven't talked to anybody inside the locker room on the Titans, but that's how I would feel. And just, you talk about that Iowa Manor catch that was ruled out of bounds, and the Callahan did not throw the red flag to challenge it. And the thing is, afterwards, he said that he didn't, he explained why he didn't throw the challenge flag, and then realized that he was wrong on his interpretation of the rule, and he should have thrown the challenge flag. In other words, even though Iowa Manor's elbow touched inbounds before he went out of bounds after he secured the ball, Coach Callahan said that he thought that he also had to have one foot down with that elbow in order for it to be a catch, and that's not the rule. The rule is you either have 2 feet or any body part except your hand. So if it's an elbow, a knee, a hip, that all equals 2 feet, even if your feet don't touch the ground at all, right? Well, the fact that he didn't know that means that he didn't throw that challenge flag, and then that was a critical moment in the play, and who knows what that might not have led to a score that would have made a difference in the game. And the fact that he didn't know that is bad. The fact that he admitted publicly he didn't know that might be almost as bad. But also you have to look at it from a standpoint of the circumstance in the game, because there's a coach in the booth that looks at those replays and then calls down to the sideline and says, yeah, throw the flag or don't throw the flag. And my understanding, based on what Coach Callahan said afterwards, was that he got a call from the booth that said, nah, it's not good. You're not going to win it. Just move on. Not worth challenging it. Well, if he got a call like that from the booth and said, it's not going to work. It's not a catch. Don't challenge it. And he doesn't challenge it. You know, is he supposed to debate it with that guy? Is he supposed to argue with him? Well, wait a minute now. Tell me. Callahan should have known the rule, and he should have asked, why is it out of bounds, and et cetera. So that's all bad. But he also got a bad call from the booth, apparently. And that guy's job is to inform the coach what he ought to do. And if that call came down and said, coach's elbow was down, it's a good catch, throw the flag, he would have thrown it. And so, you know, it was a complete failure of the entire system of whether or not to challenge. But ultimately, it's Coach Callahan as the head coach that has to know the rule. He didn't. He admitted he didn't. It's Coach Callahan that has to take the responsibility for the whole thing, which he did. But if I'm a player, I'm looking at that saying that's just one of several things in the game that my coach didn't give me a chance to win. And if you're out IO Manor, how do you feel about it, that you made a spectacular play against tight pressure coverage to get that elbow down and you don't get credit for it? You know, it's just a debacle all the way around.
You're right, Trevor, and we've talked about that a lot. And I explained to the guys even today, I said, listen, he could have as easily as said after the game, hey, listen, I didn't think we were in – I didn't think he was in bounds. I didn't want to waste a challenge flag or potential of losing a timeout, so I chose not to challenge it. But to come out and players tend to buy that a little bit better than you coming out and saying you didn't know the rule. Players at least can buy, man, he should have challenged it. He didn't. That's the head coach. But, man, he should have challenged it. But now you're questioning whether he knows the rules or not. To me, that was right. The first mistake of it, him trying to be too transparent in the world of football. Haven't he found that out? Mm-hmm. You can't do that in football. You can't be too transparent. In life, yes. Football is a different world, okay? And Brian has opened himself up to even more criticism when he wants to be that transparent. Because now, not only are the people on the outside of the building looking at you sideways, but maybe, just maybe, some of those players, like you said, Trevor, some of those players in the locker room may be looking at you sideways now as well.
Yeah, and here's the problem is that it piles up. Mm-hmm. If it were just that one thing, okay, that's not good, but we all make mistakes. Okay, let's move on. But then the clock management at the end of the first half. You guys have talked about that probably a lot in the show, but just for those who were not listening when you were talking about it, with less than a minute to go, the Titans are up 6-3. They're ahead 6-3. With less than a minute to go in the first half, but they're backed up on their own 7-yard line first down. Denver has 2 timeouts left. So instead of running the ball, running out the clock, and going into halftime with the lead, Coach decides that's the time he's going to be aggressive. So he called 3 passes. One of them was just a standard incompletion. One of them was a busted assignment because they tried to throw a bubble screen out to the right. And all 3 receivers out there went to block. One of them was supposed to catch the ball, but none of them did. They were all looking at the guy they were trying to block. So the quarterback threw the ball into the ground, clock stops. The next one was a sack right in front of the goal line. And so now they punt from their own end zone. Denver gets the ball and drives it down and has a beautiful touchdown pass right in the final seconds of the first half. So instead of them going into halftime up 6-3, they give up a touchdown. Then DK, of course, has a 71-yard or so kickoff return, and they're able to kick a field goal. So at least it was only a four-point debacle. But when you put all that stuff together, if you're the players, you're thinking, coach, we're on the road. We're backed up against our own end zone. It's loudest in the whole stadium there, right in that confined space in where the stadium used around. And we're in the back of our own end zone, for goodness sake, and we're backed up next to our own end zone. And the risk there against that kind of a pass rush and that kind of noise is that was the risk that the coach chose to take at that moment up 6-3. And I thought the risk reward was just a terrible scenario for the Titans. And if I'm a player, I look at that and I'm just thinking, why in the world did my coach put us in this position where those guys are hard enough to block anyway, coming with their hair on fire on the pass rush, and now we're in the noisy end of the stadium, backed up, and we're going to try now to drive it on down there to get a field goal or a touchdown? No.
Let's go to your wheelhouse, the offensive line. Dan Moore, Jr., how do you think he played? He had some when I went back and I watched the film, he had quite a few minus plays. But I think as a whole, you would be better to explain how not only he did in particular, but how the offensive line. I think Jamie Cushenberry, I think he's still working himself back into it, even though he had a few minus plays. But I think he's working himself back into it. But more importantly, Dan Moore, how did you think he did?
Yeah, Dan Moore did not have his best day. I think Pro Football Focus charged him with 7 pressures against Nick Benito, the Broncos pass rusher. One of the best in the league, but 7 pressures in a game to the same guy is kind of tough. Benito had 9 pressures total for the game. You talked about Cushenberry at center. You know, he didn't have any summer camp, really. He was coming back from his Achilles injury, and I really didn't think he should have played in this game. I think they should have let Corey Levin play and wait another week or so, or two even maybe, to work him back in. He was in a tough situation. And when J.C. Latham got injured at right tackle, all of a sudden the right tackle position reverted back to the difficulties of the last several years. And so, you know, overall the offensive line didn't do well. That's part of the reason. But you go back to Dan Moore, and I'm watching him from a standpoint of technique. Now, it's okay to get beat by a great pass rusher on the road when you can't hear anything. That happens, right? But I'm watching his initial pass sets, because if you are facing a guy that's just better than you, and I faced people that were better than me all the time in the NFL, the one thing you control is to take a perfect pass set and then have your first punch be accurate with your hands inside. Now, after that, he's going to start to break you down. But if your pass set is perfect and your initial strike is inside, it will take him more time to break you down, and that's the time the quarterback needs to throw the ball. But I noticed that with Moore. When he takes that first step, which he always does very well, his first initial lead step with his outside foot, he steps back and to the side, which he's supposed to. When he steps and then keeps his feet in proper perspective as he continues to step back, to get to the angle of the pass rusher, he does really well. But he tends to revert to being a defensive back sometimes. He'll take that first step perfectly, and then instead of coming to balance with the second step and then kicking out again with the third step like you're supposed to do, he'll take a perfect first step, and then he'll start to backpedal like a defensive back. You never do that as an offensive lineman, ever, ever, ever. I mean, a gust of wind will blow you over onto your back if you do that. You're out of position now, and so you lose all your strength. And a lot of the times, when Moore got beat, he took a great first step, and then he backpedaled, and then he's not able to have any power or any ability to react to side to side movement. And so, you know, that's something that you would think he'd be able to correct, but he's been in the league for an awful long time. And he had the same problem at Pittsburgh. So he's going to have to do something to fix that, or else the elite pass rushers are going to continue to have their way with him.
Trevor Maddich is with us. Trevor, let's turn to a couple of key college games coming up this weekend. I want to start with Tennessee and Georgia. Georgia's been sort of behind the scenes. They've had a couple of easy games. But one thing that's been talked about a lot is they have not really needed to throw the ball down the field effectively. The passing game's been more of an extension of the running game. And now you've got Tennessee, who's got some banged-up guys in the secondary. What do you think of that matchup?
You know, I think that if Georgia is struggling to push the ball down the field statistically, just because their first two opponents were Marshall, who lost all their good players to Southern Miss when their coach went to Southern Miss, and then Austin Peay, who, by the way, is a very good FCS team. But if Georgia was just trying to play everything close to the vest and not really open up the offense, because they have Tennessee and then the game after that is Alabama. And so if that's what they were doing, okay. But we haven't learned enough about Georgia's quarterback, Gunnar Stockton, yet, because he is a good runner. He's a gamer and a scrapper. But can he throw the ball down the field and connect with his receivers? And can his receivers get down the field and finish those plays? That's another big question mark for Georgia right now, because we didn't see it in the first two games, and we don't know if that's because of competence or if it's because of conservative game planning. And so that's going to be important for, because Tennessee is going to throw that ball down the field. And quarterback Joey Aguilar has shown in the first two games that he can drop the ball to receivers in stride deep down the field. Even though they didn't play great opponents, it was still very accurate deep throwing by Aguilar. And so Georgia can't count on just pounding the ball and beating Tennessee. They've got to be able to have the big play here and there, and so far they haven't done it. So I'm very interested to see if Stockton can be that guy.
It's a fascinating quarterback matchup for sure. Give us a thought about Vanderbilt's matchup at South Carolina. Impressive performance by Vanderbilt. South Carolina also really hasn't gotten Sellers going yet, which is a little scary, I think, if you're Vanderbilt. Sellers played such a great game, and they mauled Vanderbilt last year. But Vanderbilt looks like it's bringing a little bit more to the table.
They are. Vanderbilt's better at pretty much every position this year than they were last year. They, you know, quarterback Diego Pavia is pulling all that together. You know, they're better at the line of scrimmage, whether it's because of new guys or experience. And they've got one of the best tight ends in the SEC. And so they've got the ability to do stuff. And the fact that they just stomped Virginia Tech on the road last week tells you a lot about them, because that was basically a pick 'em game as handicapped by our friends in the desert. And Virginia Tech just ended up dominating that game when push came to shove. The thing about South Carolina is that we talk a lot about Lenore Sellers, their quarterback. And as an individual, he is phenomenal. He's about 240 pounds. He's so hard to bring down. He's like a big fullback that you're trying to tackle, whether it's in the pocket or whether he runs. He's got a cannon for an arm. He can throw it out of the building. He's all that. Everything that everybody says, it's not hype. He's that good. The question is, can the offensive line do their work when they're facing a good defense? Can their defensive line, they've got a couple guys that are really strong on the D-line, but they don't have a lot of depth on that side. So I think that Vanderbilt has a good chance to match up with South Carolina in the trenches better than they have been able to in many years. And I think Vanderbilt has a good chance to win this game. And again, part of the reason is, you look at the quarterback matchup, both quarterbacks know how to win. But I think Vanderbilt has a chance to do some things, especially now when you're talking about throwing the ball to a matchup advantage at tight end. So this is going to be a very interesting game for Vanderbilt. But if they can win this game, the next two are Georgia State and Utah State, and they might be undefeated going into Alabama. And so that could be a very interesting scenario.
Trevor Maddich has been our guest on D-Mace, Vingan, and Donick. He is brought to you every week by Houston Clinic Orthopedics, when experience matters. Trevor, great stuff as always. We'll catch up next week.
Thanks, guys.
We will react to what Trevor Maddich had to say about the Tennessee Titans coming up next. You can join us as well at 615-737-1025. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 1025 The Game. D-Mace, Vingan, and Donick, 1025, 1063 The Game. Always a pleasure to talk football with Trevor Maddich. He joins us every Tuesday at 420. And Derek Mason, I am going to ask you the same question I asked Trevor Maddich, because I was fascinated by Trevor's answer. I asked Trevor if his faith would have been shaken as a player based on Brian Callahan's performance Sunday in Denver. He said yes, unequivocally. What say you?
Depending on what type of locker room you have, and you know, was this a one-off, or has it been a series of unfortunate, you know, situations? Remember the movie, what was it called? Unfortunate something. I watched, they had a sequel to it.
A series of unfortunate events?
Yeah, something like that, events.
That is a movie.
Yeah, I watched it. It was pretty good, too. It was funny. But if you have a series of events that, you know, sort of questions your ability to be the head of this, you know, of this organization, which he is. He's the head coach. Then, yeah, players will, especially veteran players, young players, probably not so much, because they don't know nothing else. They just got here. But veteran players, yeah, and that's what you don't want to happen, because as a young coach, you want to come in what to do what? One is to change whatever has been going on. That's why they got you there. That's why they hired you, for you to change the environment. And then two, you want to get the respect of your players and for them to give you the respect you deserve. You lose credibility. You lose a sense of respect, not as a person, but as a head coach. You know, can you lead this team? If too many of these events start happening, you will lose faith first in the veteran guys and then possibly the young guys, because the young guys, they only go by what the veteran guys show them majority of the time. And if you have a veteran guy that after a while, because typically veteran guys, they just going to let it go for a minute, you know, or whatnot. And it takes a lot for them to kind of get going. And when that happens, I mean, that's not good for a locker room. If it was me, I'm in that situation like Brian, you know, if I'm on this team, I don't know if I'm necessarily losing faith in Coach Callahan right now. But these are things as a player, veteran player, and I'm like, okay, that happened. All right. I'm just going to check that out. Just put a check because, yeah, we all mess up. I didn't play a perfect game. I get it. But just like players, when a player messes up too many times, check, check, oh, minus, minus, minus. What happens in this game?
He gets cut.
He gets benched. Yeah, if not cut, he gets benched.
That too.
You can't bench Callahan. You can only remove him from his duties. I'm not saying he's there yet. Again, I am not saying he's there yet. But what happened Sunday cannot show up again any Sunday. They don't play Monday games. Any Sunday game
you can't draft they
have,
the prime time.
Yeah, they have this season. That cannot show up.
Let me ask you this. You've talked about your experience with the Baltimore Ravens, and please forgive me for not remembering every player, but mm-hmm. when John Harbaugh first arrived in Baltimore, you've talked about how you and I believe Ed Reed, other veterans on the mm-hmm. team, you spoke up for the team.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there is a collection of Titans veteran players who have gone to Callahan over the past couple of days or will go up to Callahan over the next few days before the game against Los Angeles and talk to him about what happened on Sunday and try to, for lack of a better term, hash things out, attempt to understand what happened, make sure that they're all on the same page? Do you anticipate that happening?
No.
Why not?
I wasn't going to say anything. I'm just going to leave it blank. Yeah, that's my answer. No, because, again, you're talking about two different teams. You know, our team back then was led heavy by veteran guys.
But they've got
accomplished veteran guys.
Right, but they've got Jeffrey Simmons.
Veteran guys, like I said, accomplished veteran guys. Okay. Not just accomplished in, you know, individually, won championships.
Okay.
That's what I'm talking about. Ray Lewis, mm-hmm. Jonathan Ogden.
Right.
Guys like that that had won championships. They understood. They understand. That team was different. We were a veteran-led team. And it wasn't about his play calling. It wasn't about that because, hell, we hadn't gotten to play calling yet. It wasn't about that. It was about taking care of the team physically. That's what it was about. And guys, you know, stood up and voiced their opinions based upon what was being told from – based on what the team was telling us. Us three. So we took it upon ourselves after hearing that, saying, hey, listen, we need to address this as a family, us in here. We need to address it. This is something totally different. This is the X's and O's. This is, and listen, I had my run-ins with the late, great Mike Hammerdinger. I've had my run-ins with coordinators, whether it be Billick, when he was coordinator, or Fossil was my guy, really. I'm not running into Fossil. Fossil was my guy. Who else was the coordinator back then? Why am I forgetting his name?
Marty Morningweg?
No, he's been on our show 100 times. CBS.
Oh, Rick Neuheisel.
Yeah, Rick and I's gotten into it a couple of times, you know? And he would say, Mason, you want to call the plays? I'm like, no, I don't want to call the plays. That's not my job. I'm just telling you. I'm just complaining about him. So when it comes to plays, that's a very fine line. I, as an offensive player, can go to my offensive head, my offensive coordinator or my receiver coach and say, man, what's going on? I can do that. You know, because hopefully that relationship is good enough to whereas, you know, they understand where I'm coming from. And if, you know, they got to say what they got to say and I understand where they're coming from. But it's hard for defensive guys to step over that boundary into the offensive lane. Ray never did it. Let me see. Who else?
Ed Reed
never did it. Terrell Suggs never did it. Keith Bullock never did it. Kevin Carter never did it. You know, Samari, Blaine, those guys didn't step over that line. They may have talked to us about some things, but they've never stepped over that line. I need to talk to the head coach or the offensive coordinator. In this part, and this is where we talked about yesterday, Willie, the two jobs in one. Maybe this is the part where it's like, man, you know, being a head coach and an offensive coordinator, there's a dilemma because as a player, I want to go to my head coach and say something. But I'm talking about the offensive coordinator. Right. Who's my head coach? So what do I do as a defensive player, a leader of this team? You're stuck in limbo because the head coach is your offensive coordinator. But typically, defensive guys don't cross that line over into the offensive line, just like the offensive guys don't cross that line over to the defensive coordinators, whoever they are. So, I mean, you know, I don't think there's an offensive guy. The only person that could potentially say something is Cam Ward. And Cam Ward's not going to say anything. He's just not.
You know what's interesting, Adam? You pointed out how many head coaches these days are calling the plays.
16 of 32.
So half of them. So I'm curious if this trend continues this way. And as long as Andy Reid is, you know, rising up as maybe one of the five greatest of all time, right? He's getting into that discussion. Then the trend is going to probably continue. But it is fraught with potential pitfalls like that, just the makeup of it. It takes a special coach to be able to do both and also weather the storms. It takes the right defensive coordinator. Like I'm thinking back when Buddy Ryan punched the guy right before you got to the Oilers, a couple years before you got to the Oilers, Buddy Ryan punched Kevin Gilbride, the offensive coordinator for the Houston Oilers at the time, who was running the run and shoot, and Buddy Ryan's like, you're not giving my defense a chance. You guys are just chucking it all over the place. The clock's not running. So the complimentary part of it, and I do think a trap that can be fallen, I would just think, I've never been in there, but the play caller has got a mindset, but you also have to crisscross it with playing the complimentary football. How does it affect my defense? How does it affect my team? You know, it's got to go beyond just what's the right play for this situation.
That's why I think Coach Harbaugh became that's why I believe he's such a good coach. Because the special teams coach, he's special for one of the only reasons is because he's the only guy in that building that gets an opportunity to coach both offense and defense. He's coaching offensive players and he's coaching defensive players to be on a special team. So you get the best of both worlds. You get the attitudes from the defensive side. You get the attitudes from the offensive side. You got to find a way to mirror all this together, what works perfectly, into a special teams unit. That's why I believe John Harbaugh is such a good coach. Outside of him being Harbaugh, because his brother's a good coach too, and his dad was a good coach. But because he's had sort of the best of both worlds. He had an opportunity before he became head coach to deal with offensive and defensive players, which means he had an opportunity as a special teams coach to deal with the team outside of the quarterback, deal with the team. That's why I think his tenure in Baltimore has been so long, because he's able to cross-reference both sides, because he's had that experience being a special teams coach.
615-737-1025.
I'm popping stuff around here.
Derek punctuates his point by tossing his pen cap at me.
My Nashville Predator pen cap.
Predators training camp starts
Absolutely.
Next week.
Nashville Predators.
FYI, first practice, I want to say, is next Friday off the top of my head. So hockey season will be here before you know it. 615-737-1025. Coming up next, let's talk Legarius Sneed, because there seems to be a difference of opinion, perhaps, between L'Jarius Sneed and the coaching staff about his playing time on Sunday? We'll discuss that coming up next. Willie Donick, Derek Mason, Adam Vingan, 102.5 The Game.